Welcome back to the Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. I'm Brittany Sheets here with Angela Bachman today.
Hello, happy Friday.
Happy Friday indeed. We are having some fun here today. We've been kind of hopping across the spectrum as always. We just love doing this. It's so much fun to talk about stuff and just feel like we're like, yeah, like we've got like the thumb, like our pulse. I'd mess that all up. We know what's going on, guys. It's really fun to keep up with the news because everything's always changing and it's very exciting.
And we have awesome people to tell us what's happening.
Exactly. And to, you know, kick things off here, we have Sarah Dello. She is with Generation Progress, and we're going to talk about that State of the Union and how it might impact the millennials. So welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks for joining us. We love talking to you.
Oh, thank you.
So recap for us a little bit here. There was a lot of things kind of discussed and gone over in the State of the Union. It's a hard to understand or necessarily know everything that happened, but what was the really things that stuck out to you that really might impact us as millennials?
So there are a few things that, you know, we've been talking about that were brought up at the State of the Union, but also before the State of the Union. I think one of the biggest things that people are still discussing is the president's free community college proposal. As we know, the rate of student debt or the amount of student debt that people are taking on just keeps increasing. And so the idea of getting, you know, 2 free years of college would really help benefit a lot of young people who, you know, maybe wouldn't think of going to college otherwise, or who are going to college but struggling with paying the bills.
Oh, completely. Definitely. That is a huge issue that something needs done about. It's something that's going to not only impact us, as we've talked many, many times in the past about the future, but it really will. It affects everybody across the board because we have such a high debt rate, essentially, with colleges, because it's going to impact just the economy as things trickle down.
Absolutely. And, you know, something that we talk about a lot here at Generation Progress when it comes to higher ed is that higher education should be a public good. We should be believing enough in our people to invest in them, because once we invest in our people, we're going to get, you know, so much return in the future. And I think, you know, the framing that the president used of, you know, we had this idea of free high school over 100 years ago, let's, you know, make sure that goes up to community college as well. I think that's just going to be, you know, if we can get this to be real and to happen, I think that's just going to have so much benefit for generations to come.
Absolutely. It sort of adds 2 more years to public education to give everyone more of a step up from the get-go.
Exactly. And especially when we hear economists saying, you know, we need people to have more than a high school education to really fill the jobs that that we have open right now. Well, let's make sure we're educating people for those jobs.
Well, that's true. That's a really important just point here. I mean, you need that education. It doesn't matter if you go for 2 years at community college, or if you go for 4 years at a larger university, or if you do 2 and 2, or if you go on to grad school or med school. I mean, all along the way, education plays a point. And it's in today's job market, it's become so competitive and just trying to find a job that you have to have that higher education in order to get a job, because they're going to take someone who has that higher education over someone who doesn't.
Exactly. And if we can make sure people have an education and they aren't burdened by debt, you know, then we're going to be better overall. I think the other thing that we really liked about this proposal is it's really, you know, pointing at the states and saying, hey, you have to put in money too. So we know states have been disinvesting in higher education. The amount of money they're spending per student has been decreasing mm-hmm. in the large majority of states. This is saying, all right, states, you need to step up to the table too. Yes, the federal government will put in money here, but states have to be investing in their students as well.
Absolutely. Do we know yet how this might or might not affect four-year colleges?
You know, we don't have there's still, I think, a lot of questions that are out there. One of the things that we are really excited to hear that was clarified after the original announcement was that both there's this proposal for free community college, but then, and that's tuition and fees, but students, low-income students, would still be able to access Pell Grants. So that's something we're really excited about, because, you know, the cost of living is also a huge burden on low-income students mm-hmm. and middle-income students as well. But in terms of, I think there are still a lot of questions about, you know, what could this mean for four-year schools? One thing that we know that states really need to do is to make sure that community college credits are able to transfer to four-year schools. And so that's something we're doing a lot more talking about here in our shop is, yes, community college is amazing, but we also want young people to transfer to four-year schools, which means those credits have to be able to be counted.
Oh, that's a huge thing. I know just in the area here, you can go to a branch campus at Pitt, and your credits may not transfer over to the main campus. It's still within the same exact university, but not everything transfers. And that's a common problem, not even just with community college, with just colleges, period, is your credits don't always transfer. And sometimes you have to pay to retake those classes, and that's not cheap.
It's not cheap, and it's completely unfair, right? We have students who are doing the right thing. They're going to school. They're trying to educate themselves to better their lives and their families' lives. If they took the classes, they shouldn't have to retake them. And so mm-hmm. we need to make sure that the school systems are working better together so that there's no need for duplication, because, of course, that impacts time, it impacts money, it impacts debt. And that's just not a lot of, you know, what we've got right now. We don't have enough time and money for young people to just be taking on all this additional debt and taking these extra classes.
Exactly. I completely agree. Though education was very important in this, and is a huge part of the State of the Union, was there anything else that really addressed what millennials should have been looking for?
You know, something that I was really excited to hear was the president to talk about issues that have been seen historically as quote-unquote women's issues, the issues for everyone. So access to childcare, and early childhood education, paid sick days, equal pay. That was really exciting to see, because I think, you know, there have been a lot of amazing leaders in the women's movement who have led these fights. But if women are going to be doing better, if we have access to paid sick days, if men as well have access to paid sick days, it's going to be better for our families and for our country. And so that was, I think, a really groundbreaking moment to say, hey, this is not just about women. This is about the stability of our entire country here. And so let's get to working on these issues.
I thought of that as kind of like, finally, because it seems so obvious to me that it affects the whole family, but apparently it's been a fight to get that to be perceived that way.
Yeah, I'm totally with you. I think for our generation, we have these moments of like, well, yeah, of course equal pay is an everyone issue, or of course, like, you know, both parents should be able to have access to paid sick days or maternity and paternity leave, or, you know, adoptive parents or should be able to have access to this as well. Like, it seems like one of those things that just should have happened a very long time ago and of course affect an entire family and not just one gender over the other.
Absolutely. What else should we look at?
You know, I think some of the other things that one of the things that related back to student loan debt, again, is the president did mention lowering monthly student loan payments. And this is just kind of a repeat of a program that he had talked about last year in terms of expanding the pay-as-you-earn income-based repayment program. And, you know, right now that is going to be going through a process to be figured out of who can have access to that. But it's a great program. It's something that, you know, would peg paying back your loans to 10% of your discretionary income. And so this is something that we really think that, you know, all Americans who have student loan debt should be able to access. So we're really looking forward to that, because that is definitely coming. We don't need Congress to take any action on that. So that was one thing I was really excited about. And then the other piece that was great to hear, and we've heard this on the Hill a bit, is just the need for criminal justice reform. And that is absolutely something that we think both sides of the aisle can come to the table on, because, you know, we have between mandatory minimums and some really unjust systems that are existing right now, there's a lot of work to be done there.
Yeah, there is. And that's someone that affects everyone, young, old. It affects everyone, so that's that's really important.
I'm really excited about the interest in lowering student loan, just the repayment, monthly payments. Just, I mean, personally, that affects me, so of course I have an interest in it. But at the same time, just as a whole, I just feel like that in the whole student loan thing and higher education and college is a huge setback, and it's become a huge burden that is going to have serious implications if something isn't done. Because I know I myself, as many other people who have recently graduated are, you're almost in this donut hole where you're having trouble finding a job. You find a job, it barely covers your loans, providing it can cover all your loans. And it just, you can't save the money to get out on your own and get your own footing without having like five roommates and living like pretty much, it's almost like you never left college, because if you have to live that way in order to afford just even basic, just like rent with some utilities, not even talking about like cable and like groceries.
Exactly. It's like for cable, I'm like, what's cable?
Yeah, exactly, right? Hulu, $7.99 a month.
Exactly. It's Hulu. It's Netflix, because cable is just too darn expensive. But I'm totally with you. You know, this pay-as-you-earn program and other programs that, you know, tie what you pay back on your federal loans. Now, keep in mind, this is only for federal loans, to your income, really are able to help, especially millennials, you know, just get by. And there's been some really great efforts to educate the public about these, but there's still huge underuse of them. And so this is where, you know, it's been really awesome to see, honestly, a lot of unions step in and work to educate their members about the pay-as-you-earn program, but also for those who are in the public sector, public service loan forgiveness. I mean, if you are a teacher, mm-hmm. if you're a government employee for 10 years, your federal loans can be forgiven. So, you know, there are some really great programs out there. We just as a community, as a country, from the president down to us, have to do a better job at educating our peers to take advantage of these programs that they have a right to use.
Definitely. And I believe that that forgiveness program also works if you work for a nonprofit in some cases, doesn't it?
Exactly, exactly. If you're at a 501c3 or work for a for city government or a teacher or work at another school system in other ways, like, then you totally would qualify for public service loan forgiveness.
So that's really good to know. Well, we only have about 30 seconds left. Where can we find out more about you and what you do?
You should go to genprogress.org. That's our group. And if you're interested, especially in tackling issues related to higher ed, you should check out the Higher Ed Not Debt campaign, which is also highered.debt.org. Love to work with folks.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us. We love having you guys on. You guys give us such great information. That was Sarah Dello. She's with Generation Progress. I'm Brittany Sheets here with Angela Bachman. And you've been listening to The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio.
As messed up as it sounds, in the unending struggle for justice, there is such a thing as a positive negative. This occurs when you win a struggle that you never should have had to make. A prime example is presented by the long saga of Isis Brantley. In 1997, the Dallas police force raided her school, which taught the cultural art of African-style hair braiding. It was a highly regarded school. Brantley had been braiding hair for years, even attracting music stars like Erykah Badu. But, state authorities barked, she was guilty of this horrific breach of the law, braiding without a barber's license. So she was arrested and, get this, hauled away in handcuffs. But Brantley wasn't barbering, she was braiding. So her case led to a reform intended to make it easier for hair braiders to be licensed for their art. Victory, right? Not so fast. Texas state officials, who loudly profess that they despise regulatory overreach, proceeded to overreach. Braiding artists, they commanded, must convert their shops into fully equipped barber colleges, requiring 10 or more workstations with hair-washing sinks, even though braiding does not involve washing. In 2013, still refusing to submit to this Big Brother authoritarianism, Brantley sued Governor Rick Small Government Perry's Department of Licensing. And now, 17 long years after the Texas state government's ridiculous anti-hair braiding gendarmes raided Isis Brantley's shop, locked her in handcuffs, and ran roughshod over her rights, she has found a measure of justice. A court has ruled that the state's actions are unconstitutional, not to mention arbitrary and abusive, shameful, and silly. This is Jim Hightower saying, right-wingers claim to hate big government intrusion, but where were they when their own government was intruding on Isis Brantley?
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's populist take on what the powers that be are up to. Find out more at hightowerlowdown.org.
This is Ryan Tedder from One Republic. The beat of our new song, Feel Again, was created with heartbeats of children in need. Find out how it can help frontline health workers save millions of children at everybeatmatters.org.
Brought to you by Save the Children and the Ad Council.
You're listening to The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. For more information about the show, go to theunionedge.com.
This is Solidarity News on Radio Labor.
This is the Radio Labor World Report recorded on Friday, January 23, 2015. I'm Marc Boulanger. In the report this week, labor leaders at the World Economic Forum in Switzerland push for job-rich investment instead of government austerity programs. The International Labor Organization calls long-term unemployment a global crisis. 200,000 Kenyan teachers suspend their strike for new talks. And U.S. labor unions vow to influence the choosing of presidential candidates. All that plus the Labor Start report about union events around the world. This is Radio Labor. Political and corporate leaders, plus a few unionists, have been attending the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland this week. The meeting comes as NGOs such as Oxfam warn about the dangers of global income inequality. Oxfam predicts that soon the top 1% of wealth owners in the world will have more than everybody else combined. One of the labor leaders at the forum in Davos was the general secretary of UNI, the Global Union Federation for Skills and Services. Philip Jennings was asked about unemployment in Europe, where the forum is taking place.
The biggest drag on the European economy is the fact that we've got 24 million unemployed, and the majority of them unemployed for more than 1 year. We've seen failed austerity policies, which have not delivered to the people of Europe. We have caused immense strain on the day-to-day lives of vast swathes of the population. And therefore, there's a strong political reaction coming, and I expect to see change coming in Greece. Spend some time with Greek families, Spanish families, Portuguese families, and have a look at what the consequences of these austerity policies have meant. The one in three of the Greek population are living in poverty.
Sure.
25% level of unemployment, 50% youth unemployment. There's a systemic problem there, but this can't go on.
Another labor leader attending the Davos Forum is Jyrki Reina, the general secretary of Industrial. Industrial represents a wide range of unions from mining to manufacturing to garment workers. I asked him what his federation was doing to support garment workers in the world.
The global textile and garment industry employs more than 60 million workers, very often women, very often young workers. And what is common is that very few of them earn a living wage which is sufficient for proper housing, food, education and healthcare of the family. What Industrial is doing is that we are campaigning, especially in a number of Asia-Pacific countries, in Indonesia, in Bangladesh, in Cambodia, in the Philippines, to raise the minimum wages towards living wages and finally get to a system of industrial bargaining where strong and well-organized unions would bargain with employers on decent collective agreements.
The extent of long-term unemployment in the world has been called a major crisis by the International Labour Organization. The ILO is the UN agency which focuses on matters of work in the world. Stephen Tobin is a senior researcher at the ILO.
In the world's advanced economies, long-term unemployment is a significant problem. In the European Union, an estimated 12 million people have been looking for a job for a year or more. These millions of long-term unemployed are at risk of losing the job skills they have acquired and becoming socially excluded. If unaddressed, the earnings potential for these individuals will be dramatically reduced. A strong focus on labor market policies, including job training, is needed to keep these people in the job market. In developing economies, especially in Asia, the problem is very different. While economic growth has been relatively strong since the global financial crisis, the question remains whether that growth will be strong enough to create the number of quality jobs needed for the millions of increasingly educated young people. Part of the solution is to ensure that labor market institutions are strengthened to get the new generation of younger job seekers and the employers who want to hire them the support they need.
In Kenya, teachers have been fighting for improved educational systems and decent wages. Radio Labor's senior correspondent, Seymour Ainsborough, reports.
200,000 teachers in Kenya have returned to work after a two-week strike. Primary and secondary teachers ended their strike after the country's industrial court asked the employers and the two unions involved to restart negotiations. The unions, which represent all of the teachers in Kenya's 28,000 schools, are asking for a 300% wage increase. Most of the teachers are at the bottom of the pay scale and earn about $180 a month. The unions want that increase to $545 a month and more money spent on education. Kenya's public schools have an average of 50 students per class. The struggle by the teachers to improve education in the country stems from a decision made by the national government in 2003. It decided to provide free public education for all Kenyan children, but did not provide funds for teacher training, wage increases, or improvement to school facilities. This is Seymour Ainsborough reporting for Radio Labor.
In the United States, the largest labor federation, the AFL-CIO, has announced a plan to influence the choice of presidential candidates. An election is scheduled for November 2016. Richard Trumka is the president of the AFL-CIO.
We've come together in a collective voice and we're ready to go to work. And in that spirit, I'm announcing that the AFL-CIO is launching an ambitious Raising Wages Call to Action. Now, the foundation and first call to action is simple. It's something I said earlier, that raising wages is the single standard by which leadership will be judged. That means accountability, and it starts with something that we all understand, and that's presidential politics. In 2015, the AFL-CIO and its state partners will hold raising wage summits in the first four presidential primary states, Iowa, New Hampshire, Nevada, and South Carolina. And each summit will bring together diverse voices to lay out the entire raising wages platform and establish state-based standards of accountability so that raising wages becomes the issue that any candidate who seeks our support must address, not just feel our pain, but tell us how they're going to help us raise wages for every last American out there.
Now, here with his report about union events around the world is Labor Start correspondent Derek Blackadder.
Every 6 minutes, a new story about a union somewhere around the world is posted on Labor Start. Here's a small sample of the news we collected since our last report. Last week, our top stories section included links to news about the formation of a union for migrant workers in Lebanon, the harassment of worker advocates in Hong Kong and China proper, and the global campaign to have Turkish hospital workers reinstated to their jobs after they were fired for organizing a union. Across the globe, we had coverage of strikes and lockouts in dozens of countries. Here are some highlights. Striking car parts makers in India were arrested for picketing. Sri Lankan power workers stopped work to protest the size of management salary increases. Construction workers in Panama ended their strike with a victory on all points in their dispute. South African bus drivers struck over late pay. Solid waste workers in India walked off the job to demand the regularization of contract workers. Unpaid civil servants struck in Palestine. American telecom workers were completing the third month of their strike over job security. And Guyanese civil servants started a wage dispute. Our top working women stories included coverage of a new campaign against workplace violence directed at women by a Spanish union, the growth of the Angolan Committee of Trade Union Women, and a massive protest by Indian domestic workers after a 12-year-old housemaid was murdered by her employer. Our health and safety news wire carried links to stories about the threats experienced on a daily basis by Indian bus drivers, the terrible death toll among Turkish workers, and the announcement by the union representing United Nations workers that Gaza was the most dangerous assignment for its members, with 61 workers dying there last year. Our photo of the week was of the welcome given the General Secretary of the Hong Kong Confederation of Trade Unions when he was released by police. This week, Labor Start is running 5 online actions. All of these campaigns are requested by and sponsored by unions around the world. Join us in helping make workers' lives better, or even help save those lives. This is Derek Blackadder from Labor Start, reporting for Radio Labor.
And that's it. Now you're up to date with the latest international labor news you can use. Thank you for listening. And remember, it's all about global solidarity.
Work for a living. Listen to the Union Edge. We talk about your issues and find solutions to your problem.
While college and university tuitions go up and up, higher education administrators have been spending less on students' education. Today, only a quarter of higher ed faculty has secure full-time jobs. The rest are so-called adjunct faculty, hired on a per-course temporary basis, often with no benefits, and are paid just $2,700 on average per course. Dedicated adjunct faculty across the country are joining together and fighting back in defense of their students' future. In Pittsburgh, they have formed the Adjunct Faculty Association, affiliated with United Steelworkers Union. Adjuncts and students all over the city are joining the AFA to achieve the goal of providing high-quality, affordable higher education. To know more or to support Pittsburgh's adjunct faculty, give us a call at 412-562-6967 or find us on the web at usw.org. Again, that's 412-562-6967 or usw.org. Together, we can take higher education back.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. In a new federal lawsuit, McDonald's workers say there's a widespread pattern of racial and sexual discrimination at three stores in Virginia. The civil rights suit says more than a dozen workers were fired at once at the three Clarksville and South Boston, Virginia stores. According to the workers filing the suit, top managers told them that it was too dark in the restaurants and that they need to get the ghetto out of the store. The suit also alleges that one supervisor routinely touched female workers inappropriately and offered better working conditions in return for sexual favors. Katrina Stanfield is one of the fired McDonald's workers suing the corporation.
I worked at McDonald's for about a year and a half, and in that time, I faced abuse constantly. My supervisor, Zena Lambert, would regularly harass me and other non-white workers. Whenever I was with other black workers at the store, she would say things like, "It's so dark in here," or make rude comments about our hair or how we look. After a staff meeting with Zena Lambert, said loudly, "We need to get the ghetto out of the store," which made me feel very uncomfortable. My other supervisor would regularly harass female workers at the store. He made inappropriate comments about the bodies of women at the store. He would touch workers inappropriately and send workers pictures of himself naked.
This lawsuit uses an NLRB ruling that McDonald's is a joint employer responsible for its franchise operations to make its case. The suit asserts that because McDonald's has control over nearly every aspect of its restaurant's operations, it's responsible for the discrimination and harassment the workers are alleging in the lawsuit. The IAM and the Society of Professional Engineers in Aerospace are pushing for conditions to be put on the $8.7 billion worth of tax credit that Boeing is getting from Washington State. The two unions are working to get bills through the state legislature imposing some conditions. One bill would specify the number of jobs that Boeing or any other aerospace company would have to maintain in the state in order to keep the tax credits. Another bill would require companies that get these tax credits to pay living wage jobs. Boeing got the tax credits in November of 2013. Since then, Washington jobs at Boeing have gone down by about 2,500 jobs. Part of the deal that landed the $8.7 billion in tax credits for Boeing was a contract the machinists union was pressured to support that ends Boeing pension contributions after 2016. Boeing could face another challenge to the tax credits as well. The European Union is looking at the possibility of challenging the credits under World Trade Organization rules. This newscast made possible in part through support from the United Steelworkers and from the UMWA, the United Mine Workers of America. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.